You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
While we allow the panel to clear, I'm going to remind folks that there are some seats. You should feel free to come up and fill in. I know that there are people who are sitting outside and watching on television. So if you are doing that on the outside, hello, television is talking to you. It's like the Truman Show. Come on in and have a seat in the room. And I'm going to step down to let the congressman exit. And when I come back in 30 seconds, we'll have my interview with Preet, which I'm going to set up for you. He's got some newsy things to say about all this. So a conversation of this kind, the extraordinary summit of thinkers that we've brought together from all sides of the aisle, might not have been possible. There are silver linings to the challenges that we're facing to the rule of law. And I'm so struck by the panel, although we invited sitting members of the majority party and they chose not to join us, I am struck by those career and political individuals who I know to hold every different type of perspective, liberal, conservative, and centrist on issues of the rule of law. Some of these individuals who I've clashed with over the years on questions like warrantless wiretapping and civil liberties issues come together now to support the rule of law. We, in having conversations of this kind, my friend Preet Bharara is an indispensable voice because of his deep and really unique perspective on many of these questions. Like me, a practitioner in the field of longstanding who knows firsthand all of the protagonists and the drama of the rule of law that is playing out in these days in our country. Sometimes it is tempting to forget the stakes and appreciate the drama in a literary fashion. If it didn't have such impact on real lives, Ranking Member Cummings was so articulate in his discussion of the ways that the failure to do proper oversight, that aspect of the rule of law, the separation of powers, but also the balance of powers under our Constitution, congressional oversight that makes rule of law function, that enforces rule of law. If that doesn't happen, it can cost lives, and he was very eloquent about that. We have a snippet of my conversation with Preet. The full conversation is 25 minutes long. You'll be able to find it on the Brookings website and on the webpage for those of you who are watching on the internet. On the webpage for this event, you can watch the full conversation. But we have a snippet here. Preet and I got into a conversation, you'll see, about the nature of the rule of law hurricane. And what category of hurricane are we facing? And what could make it better or worse? And in this clip, we're talking about the president's assaults on the Department of Justice, the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General, and the Special Counsel.
On DOJ Sessions, Mueller, the FBI, Rosenstein, and what effect is that having on the rule of law, and what's the long-term effect of that likely to be?
Yeah, so terrible. Speaking of the hurricane, like that's sort of like the threatening part of the hurricane. Like, are these things going to come to pass? Is he going to fire Sessions? Is he going to fire Rosenstein? Is he going to indirectly find some way to fire Mueller? If all those things come to pass, then I think the hurricane has arrived, and it's at five.
You think if Sessions is fired,
I think he figures out a way to shut down the Mueller investigation, which can't fully be shut down for reasons we can discuss. We're at a five. I just don't know if that's happening. And there's lots of folks trying to convince the president not to bring the hurricane back, you know, to shore. So there are two things happening there, right? One is it affecting the rule of law? Now, I think so long as the hurricane doesn't come back, now we're beating this analogy to death, people are doing their jobs, right? People that you and I both know who work for Special Counsel Mueller, and we know Mueller, they're keeping their heads down. I don't believe they're leaking. They're interviewing people. They're collecting evidence. They always put them together in incredibly detailed, smart indictments and charges.
Bob is not a leaker. You can't even get him to tell you what's going on when you're sitting in a meeting with him, much right. less odd background.
I totally agree with that. So they're doing their job. I think Rosenstein's doing his job. So to the extent people are permitted to do their job, notwithstanding sort of, you know, a swirling threat above them, I think the rule of law is okay. I think, however, going back to an earlier point, to the extent the president tries to undermine the people who are looking at him and his associates, that undermines the rule of law because it undermines people's faith in what the ultimate result would be. So I have tried to say from the beginning, although that gets lost and never gets reported and people don't pay attention, that I will abide by whatever the ultimate result of the Mueller investigation is. Right. So if he decides to write in a report that makes it look like the president has committed 80 high crimes and misdemeanors, I'll respect that. I will believe that. If on the other hand, and not everyone will, right? And so his reputation, depending on, you know, what people think, you know, politically and how they interpret the evidence from newspaper leaks, is something different, right? But on the other hand, if he decides there's no obstruction, there's no credible allegation of X, Y, or Z that, you know, people are talking about and speculating about, I will accept that too, because that's what you have to do. My worry is that depending on where you sit, you might not feel that way. And part of the reason is the president has done a pretty good job of undermining, you know, the integrity of the people who are working on the investigation and the constant repetition of witch hunt, attacking Bob Mueller, who's a, you know, war veteran, a war hero. You know, it has an effect among the base. And it's not unrelated to the most insidious thing the president does that doesn't violate any law. And that is to undermine, when we talk about the press, so the press, I think, is free and the libel laws are not going to be changed. But to undermine what the truth is, you know, people talk about that as something separate from rule of law. It's not. If you undermine what the truth is, and so people think that such a thing as fake news or such a thing as alternative facts, and you never know what to believe, and if the president says it didn't happen, even though you have it on tape, you believe it didn't happen, that also affects this other stuff we're talking about, right? The rule of law. Because at the end of the day, faith in decisions made by prosecutors matters because it also affects the degree to which future prosecutors decide to bring a case or not bring a case. And so the legitimacy, it's not just what Bob Mueller determines because we live in a democracy and these things matter, right? What is going to matter also is what the public reaction to that is. And it seems like Trump has already primed a lot of folks to the extent something negative comes out, to not believe it.
How do we repair? You've pointed to erosion, hurricane damage on every part of the political spectrum as a result of some of the fights we've had relating to the rule of law. In this moment when there is a profound challenge on multiple fronts to the rule of law, how do we repair the damage? Some of that you talk about in your new report, legislative and other solutions, but how do we fix what's broken with public confidence in the rule of law?
So I think one thing you need is a check and a balance. You should not have a supine Congress. I worked in the Senate Judiciary Committee for 4.5 years. I worked on the Supreme Court nominations of John Roberts and Sam Alito. But the other thing I did was work in a bipartisan way on an investigation into the politicization of things at the Justice Department, and the firing, ironically, the firing of U.S. attorneys back in 2006, which we investigated in 2007. And the gavel changed hands between 2006 and 2007. So it became a slight majority Democratic Senate. And there were all these things that seemed to be going on at the Justice Department. And I was the lead staff investigator for it, but we did it jointly, Senator Schumer's subcommittee, along with Arlen Specter. And we investigated. And we looked at a lot of things. We found out that the bad practices were happening at the Department of Justice. A lot of people resigned. But at least you had some oversight, and it was credible oversight, because we didn't issue a subpoena. We didn't engage in a certain order of witnesses. We didn't ask for documents unless it was done on a bipartisan basis. Senator Specter's staff and Senator Schumer's staff that I led at the time. And so if Congress changes hands, by the way, it doesn't have to happen that way. You know, members of the same party are permitted. There's no law against members of the same party investigating and overseeing the conduct of people who are in a, you know, a similar party who are in the administration. That has not happened because everyone in Congress, I think, has some fear of doing anything that's going to bother the President of the United States. And you have, you know, a chairman like Devin Nunes. Is he going to be at this thing? I don't mean to offend him if he's going to be there.
We invite... To finish my sentence, we invited Chairman Nunes. I would have dearly enjoyed the opportunity to have discourse with him. I do want to invite our panel to the stage. Now, if you'll come up for our third panel, please, on judicial and law enforcement independence. Okay, I'm going to follow the witness example in chairing, as I do in so many other things, of not introducing our panelists and simply going down the line. Our topic is judicial and law enforcement independence, and in a sense, everything that we've heard today from our first panel. On national security oversight and the rule of law, government operations oversight and the rule of law. Our second panel, our two special speakers, Judge Starr and Preet, all flows into this panel because we are now going to directly address the questions of the immediate, the most central players in delivering the rule of law, our law enforcement officials, our bar, and our judges, our judiciary. Our first speaker is the Honorable Gerald Nadler, the ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee. Congressman Nadler, thank you for being with us. And I'd like to begin by asking you, from your perspective, sitting on the House Judiciary Committee with oversight responsibility over judiciary, rule of law, law enforcement, looking out now at the past 20 months, what is the state of the rule of law in America, and where are we headed?
Well, thank you. And let me apologize in advance in case I repeat anything that was said in previous panels, since I didn't hear the previous panels. We have a president who has been systematically and chaotically, which is an interesting combination, attacking the rule of law, attacking the judiciary, attacking the press, attacking the institutions that we depend on for democratic governance, attacking the press, the fake news, et cetera, the judiciary, in so many ways, and attacking the FBI and the special prosecutor. Now, there are very serious allegations, as we know, that have been made about the last campaign, about Russian involvement in it, about possible collusion by the Trump campaign with that, et cetera. And we have a special counsel to investigate that. And the president has been, and the people around him have been doing everything possible to undermine, to sabotage the work of the special counsel, who has not responded. I mean, everything we know about the special counsel, we know, and their work, we know from court filings. We know from guilty pleas, from indictments, from court filings. No leaks. Remarkably leak-proof. So it's been a one-sided attack on the special counsel, on the Deputy Attorney General, and Mayor Giuliani told us exactly the purpose. He said, since the guidelines of the Justice Department preclude indicting a sitting president, if the reason to do that should be there, all the special prosecutor can do with respect to the president is give a report to the people and to Congress. And we want to taint the jury pool. We want to discredit the special prosecutor up front so that whatever he says or whatever report he gives will not be believed by as many people as possible, because the ultimate judge is Congress in a possible impeachment proceeding, the House and the Senate, and we want to taint that right away. So they've been attacking the institutions and reaching into the FBI and attacking individuals who are helpless, just ordinary civil servants who can't reply when the President of the United States says so-and-so is a terrible guy, so-and-so is dishonest. It's very difficult. Now, this is a great threat to the rule of law. When the subject of an investigation, or one of the subjects of investigation, attacks the not just the independence but the integrity of the FBI and of the special prosecutor and of the press that reports on it. Now, Congress is tasked by the Constitution with being a check and a balance. Madison designed a system of checks and balances. Congress is supposed to be a check and a balance on the administration, on the executive, vice versa. And Congress, instead of defending these institutions that are under attack and saying, hey, we've got to defend these institutions, we've got to uphold the integrity of the institutions against the president who's attacking them, and instead of holding oversight hearings, and instead of being a check and a balance, has absolutely refused to be in a check and a balance, has absolutely refused to hold the administration accountable. I've sent, as ranking Democrat, and John, I took over as ranking Democrat in the middle of the term last December, but my predecessor, John Conyers, and I have sent almost 100 letters to the chairman of the committee asking that we hold a hearing on this or an investigation of that. None of them got replies. And we have totally abdicated, not only our committee, but Congress generally has totally abdicated the check and balance function in terms of holding hearings on what's going on, not just on the rule of law, but for example, not just on this. For example, we had all these children separated from their parents at the border, and that's under immigration, which is the jurisdiction of our committee. How can you not hold hearings? It's months later, and a lot of parents still don't know where the kids are. We got a devastating Inspector General report yesterday, but where is Congress? We ought to have been holding hearings on this. We ought to have been holding hearings on the administration's switch in position on voting rights in the courts, or a switch in position on defending the Affordable Care Act. That merely affects 100 million people in terms of coverage of pre-existing conditions. But we have been totally absent, and obviously what Congress has to And you take a look at another one is the Kavanaugh hearings. I mean, regardless of what you think of Kavanaugh as a jurist, from my point of view, he's far too conservative, et cetera, but that's point of view. He sits in a hearing and attacks the Democratic Party, the Clintons. I don't know what they had to do with this at all. I'm surprised. If I were one of the senators, I would have said, what evidence do you have that the Clintons were involved in this at all, or did you make it up out of thin air? But the point is, he attacked half the country, the entire Democratic Party, the left, everybody. How can he sit on a court? I mean, a candidate for the Senate can do that, a candidate for the House can do that, a candidate for president, but a judge, a sitting judge, who wants to be a dispassionate judge to dispense, or who supposedly is supposed to be a dispassionate judge to dispense equal justice, can't do that. And that should be disqualifying by itself. And yet we see that that one party in the Senate is determined to put him on no matter what, no matter what may have happened years ago, no matter his conduct now. So there's been a total failure of oversight. And when the administration breaks the norms, I mean, there's no law that says you don't attack the judiciary, but the norms say you don't. If you want to live in a democratic society, there are institutions you must respect. We're going to have to change laws to make some of these norms. For example, the president, the presidential candidates show their tax receipts, show their tax forms. This has been done for the last 40 or 50 years. Now he simply refuses to do it. The president refuses to do it. He refused to do it for some, well, they're underwritten. He doesn't even bother with that anymore. We're going to probably have to enact legislation to say that you can't get on the ballot if you haven't released your tax returns. So, but this is for the future. Right now, we have to defend the integrity of the special prosecutor. We have to defend Rosenstein being there, because Rosenstein being there, if Rosenstein is not there, if he's replaced by some flunky, that flunky, A, could fire Mueller. B, he could simply, without the public ever knowing it, limit what Mueller is doing. Don't look at this avenue of investigation. Don't look at that avenue of investigation. And when you give him the report, give it to me, and I'll put it in a drawer, and the Congress and the people will never see it. He could completely, as you see now, with the allegations that the FBI isn't properly investigating what they should be investigating with respect to the Kavanaugh thing, that's because the FBI is controlled, by, in this respect, by the executive. But the Deputy Attorney General, or if Sessions is fired, a new Attorney General who's not recused, could completely rein in the investigation, and then we would never find out what happened. And a great miscarriage of justice would occur. And so we have got to, the first priority is to protect Mueller and to protect Rosenstein, so that we have some guarantee that that investigation will go on properly and that the American people will know it. We'll know what happened, because after all, what happened was the Russians came in to try to rig an American election. The Trump campaign either did or did not work with them in doing so, and that we have to know. And the president is accused and maybe has, in fact, been involved in an ongoing obstruction of justice, and that we have to know, too, because the integrity of the government is at stake, and the Congress... we have a bill to protect the special prosecutor. It got out of the Senate Judiciary Committee, but the Republican leadership in both houses say it's not necessary because he won't do anything. Well, I'm glad they have the power of a prophet, and they know that the president won't do anything. We know he tried to fire Mueller twice. We've seen his attacks on Sessions for refusing to... For in fact recusing himself as the law demanded, and his attacks on the people and the special prosecutor. So we shouldn't feel confident. We need a Congress that will in fact hold the oversight hearings and hold the administration's feet to the fire in all these respects.
Thank you, Congressman, for that very rich presentation. I want to tease three threads out of there. One is what is happening in Congress on the failures to do oversight on rule of law issues that the congressman described. A second is the important reflections on the special counsel. And then the third is the causes and effects within our law enforcement establishment, and particularly within DOJ. I'm going to start with Mickey Edwards, who served as a Republican member of Congress for 8 terms, for 16 years, and was the chairman of the House Republican Policy Committee, former chair of the American Conservative Union, and now a distinguished academic and commentator. And then I'll go respectively to Paul and to Kerry for special counsel and DOJ. Mickey, thank you for being with us. What has gone wrong with the bipartisan, what used to be the bipartisan oversight efforts in Congress, if they ever existed?
Well, first of all, I'm glad to be here. And, I'm glad to be here. My job has been made easier because Jerry has already said a lot of the same things I would have said. I agree with everything that he has said. Even though I'm a Republican, I know that some of the things you may question here, that my never Trump credentials are pretty strong and my never Kavanaugh credentials are pretty strong. So, but I want to take this a little farther. And I think the problems that we have in terms of the rule of law are much more deep rooted and they're much less one party oriented than we think. And I think if we're going to address the problems we have, we're going to make a mistake if we just focus on the current president and the current makeup of Congress. I am on the board of the Project on Government Oversight, POGO. We have had a great time under Republican and Democratic Congresses and presidents, being able to do the oversight and looking into what the government is doing, regardless of what administration is in power. So I am concerned about judicial independence. I'm also concerned about congressional independence. The it's not just oversight hearings. It's surrendering Congress's authority over determining when we go to war with the War Powers Act and the things we've done since. It's surrendering Congress's constitutional right to regulate international commerce, sitting back quietly while the president determines whether we're going to impose tariffs or not. We've been watching. So the issue is a lot broader than just the oversight hearings, although that's a major problem. We now have accepted as a people, certainly the Congress has, and activists have, you know, that judicial appointments are not based on temperament, learning, experience. They're based on which party you belong to. We all as a people tend to look now at the Supreme Court and federal courts as whether the person who is being nominated will be a reliable Republican or a reliable Democrat. And we form our judgments according to that. In a lot of areas, this is why I wanted to say that I am not speaking specifically about the Kavanaugh appointment or about the accusations at the moment regarding Judge Kavanaugh, but the fact that what we saw is we've divided into two camps. We don't have the results of the investigation yet, but we're in two camps. We know that he assaulted the victim, I think she was, or we know that, we've sided with the accuser or the accused before the facts come in. That's what we do. We've moved from, you know, the idea that we are presumed innocent until convicted to the idea that we're presumed guilty unless we can prove our innocence. So I just want to suggest that if we're talking about the fact that we need an American people who have confidence in the judicial system, have confidence in the courts, have confidence in the separation of powers, have confidence in the Constitution, which is, after all, you know, the supreme law, you know, that we've got a lot of problems. And if we just zero in on whether or not the current Congress, which I think has been acting abysmally, I told Jerry when we were standing out there that I'm glad I'm not there, and I feel sorry for him that he is. I think we have to look deeper. The question about integrity, belief in the propriety of our rule of law and how all the branches of our government operate is much deeper than simply say, you know, the president is a cad, or that we know these particular things about Judge Kavanaugh, or that there have been some really strange people serving on the Republican side of the Judiciary Committees. That's all. I mean, let's look deeper, Norm. It's not just lack of oversight committee functioning.
Paul, I'll come to you now on that subject of confidence and of looking deeper. You and I were on opposite sides of the Starr investigation. Judge Starr likes to tease me about that, and we became good friends nevertheless. Do you have confidence in Bob Mueller when you look deeply in the way he's conducted his investigation? What's your reaction having served you were special counsel, right, or senior counsel? You were senior counsel on Judge Starr's investigation. What's your reaction to the attacks on Bob? And do you have confidence that he will be able to finish his investigation?
Oddly enough, the answer to that question points in two different directions, which is to say that I have a great deal of confidence in him now, first because of his personal rectitude and his well-deserved reputation for professionalism and probity, but also precisely because he is a part of an institution, the Department of Justice, in which I also continue to repose some confidence. Ben asked Ken Starr a question earlier about the role of the Deputy Attorney General, and in many ways, our confidence in what the special counsel is doing is precisely grounded in the fact that he's doing it underneath the Department of Justice. And we have confidence not just in him, but also in the Deputy Attorney General and in his professionalism. And we have a confidence in the structure of the Department of Justice that goes back, 200 years or 150 years, I guess it was, 1870s that the department was actually created, and it has a tradition of professionalism. It has policies. They may not be policies we like, but somebody asked earlier about the indictability of a president while sitting while he's a sitting president. The department has had a policy about that for more than 40 years, 50 years, and we have a confidence that that policy is independent of politics and is not grounded in my team or the other team, but rather in their judgment. And we may think it's the wrong judgment, but that grounds us a lot in thinking that whatever comes out of the Mueller investigation, I like Mr. Behara, think that it's going to be a matter of integrity if he's allowed to continue. That does lead directly to the second answer, which is in some way our confidence in that professionalism comes at the cost of its dependence on the department for top cover, for its existence. And the reality is that, as Congressman Nadler said, that right now is working quite well, but it could change turn on a dime if President Trump were to exercise his executive authority and replace Rosenstein or replace the Attorney General with somebody who is more complacent and complicit and compliant, the three C's, for the president's own viewpoint. I don't see how you can square those circles, right? I mean, we tried an independent counsel law for 20 years, and we stopped because we generally thought that was an unsuccessful effort. And the reason we thought it was unsuccessful was precisely because it took that prosecutorial authority outside of the umbrella of the department broadly writ and made it kind of a one-size, a single-purpose prosecutor with one mission and one focus. And the reality of that, I think, is when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail to you. And so we decided to bring the prosecutorial function back into its traditional home within the Department of Justice, and that brought with it more regularization, more legitimacy, more professionalism, more, but also less independence. And I don't see how we can square the circle. The pendulum keeps swinging back and forth. We've gone from independent counsels to special counsels to independent counsels to special counsels again. And now, there's probably going to be a swing backwards in reaction to the dependency of the Mueller investigation. And 20 years from now, we'll go the other way. So my answer to you is it's an unsquareable circle.
Kerry Cordero, the Robert M. Gates Senior Fellow and General Counsel at the Center. I know I said I wasn't going to introduce him, but I lied. At the Center for a New American Security, a Brookings colleague because she's associated as a contributing editor of Lawfare, and also my CNN colleague. I wish I could just play the conversations in the CNN green room. There's a lot of bold predictions that are made there. Kerry, has Rod Rosenstein done a good job so far of the logical impossibility that Paul lays out in acquitting the rule of law in America and in defending the Mueller investigation of squaring the circle? Has he managed to do that so far? And is he going to be able to continue that?
There we go. Thanks again for the invitation to join this discussion. I think that Rod Rosenstein has done an incredible job of maintaining the integrity of the special counsel's investigation. I'm reminded in particular of the press conference that he gave when one of the major indictments were read. And it was so unusual for a Justice Department major indictment press conference, because usually you would have, in a normal investigation that was conducted by one of the divisions, you would have the assistant attorney general for that division, you would have some representatives from the FBI or the other agencies that might have supported the case, you might have the FBI director or a deputy director, and there would be sort of a supporting cast that would support the prosecutor, the head of the Justice Department who was announcing that. And instead, Rod Rosenstein stood there alone and announced those indictments. And he, by doing so, he provided, in my judgment, the political cover for the special counsel and its investigative team to continue to do its work as insulated as they possibly could be from the political influence that was trying to be asserted on them nearly every single day. And so I think he's done a terrific job. I think he's been really a linchpin of consistency in terms of holding that together. I do worry if he were removed from his position, whether or not somebody else would feel more pressured, because there has been so much pressure from the president and from the White House. I don't worry so much that a new individual would come in and immediately fire Bob Mueller as the special counsel. I worry more about what could be done on the margins that actually could have a substantive effect. So these are a few people on other panels have described these a little bit, but some of the things that could be done would be not, I think as Congressman Nadler mentioned, not letting the report actually be revealed publicly or provided to Congress. It could be something like not being willing to refer certain criminal matters that come to light during the course of the investigation be referred to the U.S. Attorney's offices, like we've seen with the referrals to the Southern District of New York. It could be decisions not to pursue certain areas of where the investigation is intending to go. For example, one area that we haven't seen a lot of public evidence of that perhaps is part of the investigation has to do with financial matters. More depth on potential campaign finance or foreign influence financially into the campaign, with one exception, that one plea that was made with a foreign contribution that made its way to the inauguration committee. So I think he has done as admirable a job as one could have done. And I also want to say a word about Attorney General Sessions, because regardless of where one stands on the policy positions that the Attorney General has taken, and I, for one, have been a significant critic of the zero-tolerance policy and what has ended up as a result of the implementation of that on the family separations out of DHS, Attorney General Sessions made what was probably the most important career decision, which was to recuse from the special counsel investigation. And for that, I believe that he demonstrated his respect for the institution of the Justice Department and the institution of the Office of the Attorney General.
Since in your DOJ capacity, you were a frequent consumer of FBI materials and in constant communication on counterintelligence and other issues with the FBI, I'm going to start with you, but then I'm going to go down the panel. How much damage has been done by the tussle? I agree with the heroic efforts of Rosenstein and the surprisingly strong performance on this narrow slice of issues that Attorney General Sessions has been absolutely unbending on these on the Mueller investigation issues. But how much damage has been done? I want to go down the panel and ask just short answers, your assessment of the damage. Then I want to do one round on the panel on how we begin to repair those breaches, and then prepare your questions, because we will come to all of you after that. So just quickly, actually, I'll start with Congressman Nadler. How much damage has been done to the to the rule of law? Yeah, you've got it. How much damage has been done to the rule of law?
I think substantial. It's very interesting. Some people have noted that when Comey had his meeting with the president just before he was fired, he then called in the senior leadership and told them what happened. Every single person in that meeting is no longer with the FBI. They've all gone. The president and some of my colleagues in the Judiciary Committee on the Republican side have been attacking individuals in the Justice Department, in the FBI by name. And I would assume that some of them have been very seriously damaged, and some of them have been fired, and some of them are just standing there. But I assume that there will be a lot more lack of courage or just people keeping their heads down in the future, because we have shown, or it has been shown, that individuals in the Justice Department, in the FBI, career people, are vulnerable to political attack. That will take quite a while to get over.
Carrie?
So two thoughts. First of all, with respect to the Department of Justice, I think the institutions have been holding up relatively well, in large part due to excellent leadership on that point in terms of protecting the institutions from Attorney General Sessions and Rod Rosenstein and FBI Director Wray. I have been more concerned about the ability of the intent by the president to try to corrupt law enforcement when it comes to DHS. You know, DHS has more law enforcement officers than the FBI does. If you combine the agent force from Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Customs and Border Patrol. And what we've seen, as demonstrated from the Inspector General report that the congressman mentioned that just was released, the Department of Homeland Security Inspector General did an initial review of how the Department of Homeland Security implemented the issues on the border and the separation of children. And they found that there were no databases in place, no comprehensive database in place that would assist in the reunification of children. They didn't track, they didn't have a mechanism for tracking young children who were not yet verbal with being able to reunite them with their parents. And so where if we want to have hearings on this, Secretary Nielsen would be at the top of my list to call to explain how it is that a system became so broken. And so I don't think that we've seen the same level of institutional oversight internally in all departments as we have with the Justice Department and the FBI. One other quick thing on the other area where I think it will take some substantial time to repair has been on the national security side, is the politicization of the declassification of national security information. The interactions that have taken place between the White House and the assistance that they've had from some allies in Congress, in particular in the majority on the House Intelligence Committee, has really been a step beyond anything that I've observed in the last over 15 years of working with the national security community. And the politicization of intelligence information, I think, is something that is going to be harder to rectify and will take more time to repair.
Mickey, you wisely counseled us to take the broader view in assessing the damage. So just a quick word, if you would, about the level of the damage. And then if we can start to focus a little bit on how to fix it, Mickey. You're one of the wisest people I know in fixing what's broken. So how to fix it?
Well, first of all, let me just say I agree when you broaden this, because you didn't mention education, you didn't mention interior. I mean, there are a lot of other areas where this needs to be done. I where you start by fixing it, where in my mind the greater problem is, and I think the greater problem, and it has lasted longer than these 2 years that we've suffered through, is Congress. Is Congress failing to not only do its oversight, but to assert its authority. If I were there, which I'm not, but if I were there and the administration failed to turn over reports that we needed to see, I would say, well, we will stand in adjournment on the nomination until we receive them. The Congress has enormous amounts. Congress has great authority, great power that it never exercises. It acts as though it is a subservient branch to the executive branch. It has done that under presidents of both parties and Congresses of both parties. And so the answer is very simple. Congress reasserts the authority. Jerry Nadler has more authority and is backed up by the party leaders and by the speaker and the majority leader in the two houses to do these things, and you'll see a change. You know, that's where the fundamental problem is. So people talk about get back to regular order. You know, that's kind of a bit of a meaningless phrase because regular order did not exist when I was in Congress. You know, it was not really bipartisanship. It was dominance and submission. It was like, you know, 50 Shades of Gray. But if Congress fixes itself and reasserts its role, a lot of this will be fixed pretty quickly.
Paul, you have the long perspective also. Like me, you've been doing this for a while, and you're a scholar as well as a practitioner, even if you scoff at that. And you participate in one of the great, what has emerged, and I, as one of the great voices, one of the great bipartisan institutions, the Lawfare blog, which is housed here at Brookings, in which brings together people from every different part of the political spectrum. What are your thoughts on how we fix what's broken, and in particular the afflictions of unthinking partisanship on all sides?
Indeed, I am honored to be part of the Lawfare group, and thank you for mentioning that. My fix turns on the fact that I actually see a slightly different problem, which is that given the complexity of executive action and American government today, so much of what we do depends on a belief in the well-meaning discretion of executive actors. No matter how strong Congress gets, no matter how much oversight it does, it's always going to be in a position of having to rely somewhat on the well-meaning discretion of the executive. An example is in trade, right? We have trade laws, but we have national security exceptions to them. Given the size of government, it is almost impossible to imagine a world in which the executive doesn't have a great deal of discretion, cabined by oversight, by audit, both from the inspectors general and from congressional oversight. The true horror of what has happened over the last 2 years is that we can no longer have that confidence in the well-meaningness of the discretion, even in situations where we might have thought that the president was exercising that discretion in a way with which we disagreed, or a way we thought was perhaps a little self-serving or partisan in nature, we basically started from the assumption that every executive had as a ground the success of the American Republic and the best interests of the American people. We've lost that, I think. And that is my assessment of what is the true fracturing of the last 2 years. So then the question is how to recover that. And I think that the only real answer to that is time. Is, you know, a couple of presidencies, one from each party, that restore our faith that we can elect people who, even though we disagree with them, are kind of headed in the direction of the best interests of the country, even if we think that the way they're choosing to get there is not the way that we personally would choose. And that means for me that some of the immediate things that have been suggested, like hearings and congressional oversight, are short-term palliatives that staunch the bleeding, tourniquets, if you will. But the only real answer is for the American public to insist on candidates for presidency and in their Congress who are not nonpartisan, because that's impossible, but are well-meaning partisans. And I don't know if we can achieve that. I know that I plan to vote that way for the immediate future. I like to think I have in the past as well, but I know that I will in the future. And that's kind of my submission. Larry Kramer, who was a professor of law at Stanford, wrote a wonderful book about people's constitutionalism. And essentially, his bottom line is, we get the Constitution that we deserve. And, you know, all the rules of law and all the constraints of structure that we have, no matter what we do, can't substitute for whether or not the American public wants a particular form and responsiveness of government. And I think he's right as a descriptive matter. I'm not sure I like it normatively, but as a descriptive matter, he's accurate. So vote for good guys. That's how we get it.
Yes, we heard from the audience and gals. The tension in the Kramer argument, of course, is that there's a substantial portion of the Constitution that is protects the country from the desires of the majority for what they want.
That's why I said it was normatively not quite right, but I think descriptively it's accurate.
With that caveat, we agree. As usual, since the Starr investigation ended, we've agreed on everything. Congressman Nadler wants to intervene, so I'm going to give him the last word, and then we're going to come to you for your questions.
Thank you. I just wanted to add that I agree very much so. The Congress has abdicated not just on oversight, but for instance, if you look at the political history of the United States, one of the great battles, one of the defining issues between political parties for much of our history was the question of tariffs. Whether it was the Tariff of Abominations in 1828 or Smoot-Hawley in 1932 or whatever, but this was decided by Congress. So we enacted, I shouldn't say we, I wasn't there, but Congress enacted many years ago the current tariff regime and put in a national security exception, which has now eaten the rule. The president can impose a tariff on anybody if he calls it national security. The Canadians were properly insulted that we viewed them as a threat to our national security. Congress has got to rewrite these laws so that we have less discretion, because we can apparently not trust the discretion of the executive if he's just going to completely abuse that kind of discretion. Same thing goes with war powers. I was very critical of the Obama administration for intervening in Libya with no exigent threat to the United States and without permission of Congress. The same thing was true on any number of occasions. With Trump should not have been able to attack Syria without going to Congress. So we have to get, and any number of other occasions, we have to rewrite these laws so that the executive can't do these things. And you look at, there is a problem, because you look at, for example, the EPA. Now, Congress cannot write a law that says mercury is okay to 15 parts per billion and isoethyl ethyl is okay to 17 parts per billion. You have to leave that to somebody to gather the scientific evidence and decide that. So we've delegated that to the EPA. But the EPA is now captured by appointments, and the EPA is just one of any number of agencies, of the regulatory agencies, that are captured by appointments from the regulated industry and that are serving the regulated industries rather than the purpose which Congress set these up. And the only answer to that is Congress has to have oversight and bring this to public light and maybe have remedial legislation, although the legislation cannot totally eliminate the discretion of these agencies, because Congress cannot write all these rules for things that must be regulated in this kind of society.
they're going to, I predict that there will be fascinating new alignments, left, right, and center of ideas as ones like that, limiting executive agency discretion, which has long been, some conservatives have long felt the executive branch has overreached. So we're going to see some interesting new alignments, like the ones we've seen today around rule of law issues. I'd like to come out to the audience now. I'll take a cluster of questions. There's a gentleman back there holding a white paper. There's a lady here with a red sweater, and there's a gentleman there with a blue suit and a red tie, one of my own personal sartorial models. So we'll take those three questions as a cluster. And I'm going to be equally tough as my previous moderators. Questions, please, not comments or speeches.
Well, thank you very much. I'm Jerry Malone from London. And the first thing I'd like to say is I'm rather pleased that you let me in here still.
One begins well, we probably didn't know you were from London.
Well, I'm glad that this will be my first but last, clearly, attendance at this thing.
God forbid.
Can I make a comment about the most important thing about the rule of law, I think, is an independent judiciary? And an observation, however one looks at it, it has become clear to an outside observer that there is no independence in terms of the way that you nominate your judiciary anymore and the system is flawed. When you set up your constitution, you rightly did it on three pillars, the separation of powers, and you did it saying that we in Britain had no separation of powers.
I'm just going to stop you there because you've posed an excellent question, which is whether the judiciary has maintained its independence given the current state of the nomination process, something which some of my colleagues on this panel occasionally think about. So we're going to cabin that question, and we're going to come over and get the next question over here.
Good morning still. I'm Diane Russell. I thought I came further than anybody else. I flew in from Maine this morning. So I'm going to read this because I want to get to the point quickly.
It's all foreigners here today.
I know. We call it from away, Norm. I think about how we translate this to voters. We keep talking about how partisanship plays into this, but that leaves everyday voters hearing the he said, she said, which we've seen particularly with the Kavanaugh hearings. But this isn't actually about partisanship. It's about an intentional switch to authoritarianism with almost no check on that power. And that is setting us up for a very real constitutional crisis, which I think is what the ultimate point of this symposium has been about. How do we get back on a course toward reason and democracy where, as you put it, sir, the best interest in the country is actually a goal of our elected leaders? And is there a better word than partisanship that we can start using? Because I think partisanship isn't really covering what's really happening.
Okay, so we have independent judiciary. How do we get back on track? And now our third question for the panel.
Excuse me. Hi, Carl Golovin, a retired special agent, U.S. Customs. I was a 9/11 responder. Domain reference, idealiveson.net. My question fundamentally is whether can we have rule of law without true transparency in the most important events in our society's experience? And I would go back even to JFK's assassination. I was very hopeful Trump would simply do nothing, and then by law, all of the still withheld records were to have come out in October. But he said yes, then he said no, and so the national security state still controls important records the public needs to know. As a 9/11 responder, I helped go through the rubble of World Trade Center 7. Ms. Cordero, I understand you recently wrote an article about the 9/11 Commission report. That report did not even reference that 47-story building that collapsed in 7 seconds at 5:20 in the afternoon on 9/11, which wasn't hit by a plane and tends to undermine the entire official conspiracy theory of 9/11. So I would ask, can we have transparency on those two most important issues?
Judicial independence, how we go back to the American people on these questions, and the importance of transparency. I think I'm going to just go down the panel, given the time, and you can reflect on any of the three questions that you wish. Judicial independence, how we talk again to the voters, and the importance of transparency.
Well, on judicial independence, I think you have to recognize a one-sided development. Presidents traditionally have appointed judges on the recommendation of the local senators or whatever, you know, and period, there wasn't a concerted effort to stack the judiciary in a particular ideological direction. That changed about 30 years ago. The Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation have determined that we have to have a very conservative, I would say right-wing judiciary, and they've taken Republican presidents, and now Trump openly says he'll only take candidates from the Federalist Society list. And you have a very deliberate attempt to stack the judiciary from one point of view. That is not symmetrical. You don't have you have not had the same thing from the Democratic Party. President Obama wanted diversity, and he certainly wanted somewhat more liberal, but he wasn't trying to stack the judiciary from the left, as you see here. And as a result of this, you see in the last several years, routinely now, something you never saw before, and that is when a decision comes down from a court of appeals or even from a district judge, they'll tell you that this judge or the two judges in the majority were appointed by Republican presidents or Democratic presidents or this president or that president. You never used to see that. But now you've grown to expect that you get one result from a Democratic-appointed judge and a different result from a Republican-appointed judge. That's poisonous. How you get away from that? The Senate has to do a job of seeing that judges are top flight and not all one-sided on an ideological basis.
Kerry, you worked on a presidential campaign, the Kasich presidential campaign. You advised him. Any thoughts on the voter issue or any of the other questions you want to comment on?
Actually, if you don't mind, I want to take on the transparency questions since I know we're short on time. Okay. So I want to speak to transparency because it's an area, particularly in the national security arena, where in the last few years we've seen a lot of movement, but in the last year, it's going down a path that we need to be concerned about writing. And that is that in order for transparency, particularly about national security information, to be effective, in other words, the intelligence community, the national security community releasing information, declassifying information to inform the public about either laws, how laws are interpreted, policies, or the actual substantive national security information, it needs to be, in my judgment, timely, in other words, tied to something that's of some relevant current public interest. Two, importantly, it needs to be accurate. So garbage getting released publicly or false information getting released publicly under the banner of transparency is not actual transparency. And third, it needs to be meaningful in some way. And so going to the substance of what the information is, again, it has to add something. In order for national security information to be, in my judgment, rightfully released, it needs to be adding to the public debate in some meaningful way. The intelligence community over the last few years, under White House and Director of National Intelligence leadership, made a lot of strides in releasing more information publicly. Some of it they did voluntarily. Some of it they did in response to unauthorized disclosures of information. And some of it they did it because Congress legislated that they had to. However, what we're seeing recently is both from the White House and from parts of Congress is information being released that is saying it's national security information. It's doing it because they're saying it's under the banner of transparency, but it's not accurate or it's not vetted or it misrepresents what is actually going on behind the scenes. And so I think generally my judgment is that we can't go backwards on transparency. I think we actually, just the way that information flows and the demand for information is just such in our current era that we have to move forward on transparency. But we really do need to pay attention, and consumers need to be aware of the environment in which it's being released.
Paul, I've come to you last all day because you're down, way down there at the other end of the dais. So I'm going to go next to you on transparency or judges. Or reaching the voters, and then finally we'll let Mickey bring us home.
You get to bring us home. I was glad because I didn't want to be the one person standing between everybody here and getting out of this room, right? Yeah. So I'll be brief, and I'll pick up on two of the three briefly on the issue of judges. I actually think that, notwithstanding the difficulties that we're going through right now in the nomination process, the judiciary has been a shining light in the last couple of years. They have exercised far more scrutiny than they typically have over national security and immigration issues in particular. And that, you know, I'm not sure whether that's a welcome change or not systematically, but in this context, it certainly is. You look at the immigration laws, for example, and that's an area where for years we've said that the executive discretion is at its maximum, and yet we have seen a number of instances of judicial retrenchment and restrictions on what I think are rightly characterized as abuses of that discretionary power. So I'm not as concerned just yet about the judiciary's transformation as perhaps Congressman Nadler. I see it as still a bit of a happy point. What bothers me most, what concerns me the most, is recovering the civility of the conversation, and stopping the trope that, you know, people I disagree with are evil, wrong, and bad. And you know, I reflect back on my own 35 years in this town, and I look back on my own conduct, and I see instances in which I have not upheld that virtue as well as I might have, and in which I became quite enamored of a particular viewpoint and convinced of the rightness of my views, and not just that, but also personalized the dispute in ways that. And so I think the only way is for each of us individually to recommit themselves to a debate about policy, not about personality. And that's extremely hard in a world in which the leading political actor on the world stage is all about personality and converts every dispute about policy into a debate about his personality. But nonetheless, that's really the only answer. So, I know you're looking grim. I don't, you know, institutional changes that empower your opponents, where you say, "I will not." I love what Congressman Jolly said earlier about giving the minority systematic rights. That's a great idea. I hadn't thought about that before. But that's my answer. It's not as happy an answer as you wanted,
Congressman Edwards.
So nobody eats until I shut up, right? I want to go through each of them, but very, very quickly. I completely agree with what you said about the judiciary. I think we look at the way the Supreme Court divides so often, 5-4, Democrats against Republicans. We look at what happens in the confirmation process. But overall, we have seen over the last couple of years a number of federal judges doing a good job of stepping up, performing their duties, putting a stop to things, even going back to when John Roberts tried to find a way and did find a way to reconcile the differences on the Obamacare dispute. So that I do think the federal judges are doing better than we might think. But to your question, I disagree a little bit. Partisanship is the issue. Political parties exist for one reason, to gain power, which you do by stopping the other people. George Washington was right in his farewell address. And so partisanship is not on the side. Partisanship is why we're here. People today decide before the facts are out, based on which party they're in, what they believe. So that's a fundamental problem. Unless we find some way to reform that, we are going to not get out of this problem. Rule of law, transparency, the picture that comes in my mind is about the fact, have you ever served, Jerry, on the Intelligence Committee? So I'm always struck by the fact that on the Intelligence Committee, the executive branch will come to the members of the intelligence committees and say, "We will give you this information and only this. You cannot bring in a staff member, and you cannot tell it to anybody else," to which the proper response is, "We're the Congress of the United States. We make the laws. We will tell you what is classified, what is not, who we can share it with, and what we will do about it." So, I mean, it does come back. You know, much of the problem we have now stems from a Congress under both parties that does not do its job, does not assert its authority. If we got back to the constitutional model of separated powers, separated and equal powers, you know, I think we would solve an awful lot of this. I wanted to say a word because, you know, mentioning the Federalist Society, if there was ever an organization that was misnamed, it's the Federalist Society.
I'll just end on an optimistic note of my own analysis. The United States, indeed, the liberal democratic project on both sides of the Atlantic has been through a century of profound challenges, challenges far worse than the ones we face now. I wrote in the New York Times on Sunday about this model. Every time when we come through those, we're in the midst of them, much deeper, much more dangerous challenges, the rule of law and the rest of our project, our democratic project, they seem insoluble. And every time we've come through them, and when we do, exactly that, the notes of healing, of oversight, of congressional functionality, of bipartisanship, of joining together, of affirming the values that are much deeper than what separates us, flourish. And there's a healing moment, and we end up better. The great reforms that guide government, that allow us to talk about the failings and the legislative solutions that are now fixes, those reforms came out of the Watergate crisis. So I believe that we are going to come out of this crisis stronger than ever, that the rule of law as a necessary corrective part, these crises serve that function. We've solved tougher ones with the help of leaders like my friends on this panel today and all of our speakers from all sides of the aisle who we've been privileged to hear from today. The rule of law is going to make it through this moment and will emerge on the other end. No one knows how long the passage will be. But we're going to emerge on the other end stronger than ever. I want to thank my friends for being here with me, and I want to thank all of you for joining us at Brookings. Thank you.